Hi, I'm Robert Grange from the Department of Human Nutrition, Foods, and Exercise at Virginia Tech. And I'm the graduate chair for our department. We're currently revising our graduate curriculum. And there's been a request from our faculty to introduce a team science course. So I'm a basic scientist. I collaborate. I've had good success with collaborations. But I had to admit I knew nothing about team science or the science thereof. And so I'm really struck by some of the comments and the information that's been presented at this conference. In particular is the comment about marriage and prenuptial agreements. Well, I've been married for 29 years. We did not have a prenuptial agreement. And as many of you know, whether you've been married for a long time or a short time, that there can be many ups and downs. And over the course of this first day and a half, there's been many ups and downs because there's really good things about team science. And then there's the dark side. And that's kind of scary. But, you know, I'm encouraged now, especially after hearing the availability of these tools, to build a really good course for our graduate students. Because one of the things that struck me is that the success of the teams really depends on those who comprise the teams. If they already have information about how to be a team player in the realm of science, I think they'll be a lot more successful. So I'm also encouraged to hear that there's this course taught by your postdoc at Massachusetts Medical School, and I hope to get her name. So I don't really have a question other than to say, perhaps at my peril, I invite recommendations on the types of information that should go into a graduate course. So if anybody, you don't have to answer me now, but if you have suggestions, and I open this up to the audience, I really appreciate it because I'm supposed to go back and report to my faculty, and I want to have good things to tell them. So thank you.
Before you guys get to answer, you're going to come right over here. I'm going to give you the syllabi for both of our courses. Okay. But now you guys can go ahead and answer.
And I'm going to suggest, I think Paul Estabrooks is probably one of the driving forces that's been trying to get you to offer this course. He knows a great deal about this as well.
Yeah, actually, Paul is the one who suggested I come here with him, but he's at Disney World with his wife and child. But he said, go ahead, Rob, you go on and learn all you can.
Well, I'd also recommend that you bring into the course some good case material. Talking just about general principles can be a little bit abstract at times, but having some concrete examples of things that have worked or not worked, I think, is helpful.
I have one suggestion, one question. I really like to see this online site where you would actually share relevant resources, relevant papers, etc. I would like to encourage you to consider providing this in a fielded format. So if you can put the publications in BibTeX or EndNote or anything else that gets the author names extracted from the titles and from the journal names, then we can actually mine this more easily if this is an option. The other part is that I believe a science of team science really needs data sets. And so the question then becomes, who is collecting data sets? Who is making them available for teaching purposes, for research purposes, so that we don't have to clean the data again and again and again or collect them again and again, being more of a burden on certain types of teams, which might actually generate a lot of data, but ideally it's only collected once, it's cleaned once, and it's then provided in a way that other people can benefit from it. And ideally then people also get cited for it and get promoted for it and so on. So creating a data infrastructure for the science of team science should be one of the major efforts. And I hope you also collected these kind of pointers, but also like to support and fund these kind of efforts.
So thank you for that. We have a model in our program of a group that's developing a database in the behavioral sciences around constructs, measures, and they also are including data sets. And this is something, in part, we've modeled what we're doing after, but I think that we haven't continued to focus on the data set, so thank you for reminding us, because I think that's something that we can move towards in a phase two, but we don't want to forget about making sure our infrastructure will support that, so thank you.
We also, in the project I referred to, have created a database that's got over 200 collaborations in it. We're in the process of moving it from Michigan to Irvine to follow us, And it'll be online and up pretty soon, and we're going to also freshen it because in the last several years we've missed a lot of new collaborations. And it's a quite large set of examples of projects.
Jack Pincus with Silicon Technologies. Two questions, one for Kara Hall. I didn't get whether your toolkit is online yet live or is going online.
It's going online. We hope to have a beta version by July.
Okay, great. Thank you. And for Gary Olson, I've read your book. It's very interesting, and I learned a lot. It's clear that many collaborations fail. What struck me, though, is there are a number of organizations that fall into the category of venture philanthropy, organizations like the Michael J. Fox Foundation, the Milken Foundation, and most notably the Mylan Repair Foundation, where they have organized academic collaborators and they claim to have had success. What do you ascribe the difference to?
Well, I guess I'm not familiar enough with those examples to really answer the question. I'd like to follow up on that.
I'm Eric Bing from Duke University in Los Angeles. We've talked about sort of the difficulties of doing sort of cross institutional collaboration and cross-disciplinary collaboration. One collaboration that we actually haven't talked much about, or actually probably all about, is collaborations with communities, because they're often an important part of the team, of our science teams, that we need to incorporate into our research. Any recommendations on how we would do that, or are your tools at all useful in helping us think through our collaborations with communities and consumers?
I guess the best I could say is that there's certainly in the context of doing transdisciplinary research and action research, that there's a literature out there that talks about doing that in bridging, especially as Julie Klein was talking about, internationally they often define transdisciplinarity as including that community stakeholder. So they have a literature that's also something that can be mined.
And I guess one category of project that is in our database are what we call citizen science projects. And there might be a little bit of information in those about sort of how you get people engaged and interested in participating in activities like that.
Phil Greenland from Northwestern. I just want to say a few words about Mylan Repair Foundation in response to the previous comment. One of our scientists here at Northwestern is funded by Mylan Repair Foundation. They're an extremely unusual example, but it's kind of interesting what they've done. Very small foundation located in California. They've raised only about a total of about $30 million, which, considering what they want to accomplish, is a small amount of money. They want to cure MS. And they spent a lot of time when they established the foundation talking with scientists about what inhibited science. So they heard about things like, well, it's difficult to work across different disciplines. They heard about it's difficult to get any science done because you have to spend a lot of time organizing meetings and also a lot of time writing grant applications and things like that. So what they did was really provide a totally new model. There are no grant applications to the Mylan Repair Foundation. They select the scientists that they want to include on their team. So you're sitting in your office one day and you get a call. Hello, this is Mylan Repair Foundation. We are interested in your work. We would like to fund you. There's no grant application. We will organize all the conference calls, et cetera, et cetera. They've been phenomenally successful, really. They have an interesting website. They have stories on the website about how they've pushed this process along. They have also, kind of interesting, they chose scientists from different disciplines who in some cases never heard of one another. The scientist here at Northwestern is a really terrific, wonderful, nice guy, but he's pretty discipline-oriented. He said to me that he's an immunologist. He said he had never literally talked to a neuroscientist about his MS research. It's kind of striking. And so they have created this family of investigators now in a way that, you know, it's an interesting case report. And, you know, speaking of case reports, somebody from the Harvard Business School has become aware of this foundation and joined the team as sort of the chronicler of the story and is writing it up. But it's a rather unusual model. And we thought about whether we could try to create a similar model in our CTSA at Northwestern, and the truth is we can't afford it. But we can't afford it in two ways. We don't have enough money, and we would also have to pick winners, and that would make a lot of losers. So, and we could maybe afford, you know, to pick one area that we would really invest in, but that's, again, a different model than what academics, you know, tend to do, is to say, okay, we're going to invest in diabetes and everything else is not important. So, and anyhow, it's an interesting story.
Okay. So I wouldn't change the toolbox name. I like the toolbox, and I envision it'll be a big, shiny, pink one. Okay, so, but I have a question. We've heard about some really spectacular tools, and I'm all giddy about all of them and can't wait to use them all. And then I imagine that some of the practitioners of Team Science are going, I'm giddy, but I can't possibly use them all. And so how do we then move from developing the tools and even bringing them all into one place, Carol, like your website, and being able to direct people to them, and then best helping folks select the right tool for the right job and really making them tools that our individual faculty can use or that folks at their institutions can help? And the reason I ask this question is that there have been a number of really outstanding tools for helping investigators identify new funding opportunities. These are things like Community of Science costs and the Illinois Research Information Service, IRIS. And for, you know, a couple of dozens of years, institutions have had site licenses that are very expensive for these tools, and very few faculty members use them. And so we haven't been able to take advantage of the full potential of what these resources avail us. And I'm just wondering how we can, in thinking about things early on for science of team science and team science tools, look at the lessons learned from that project and make sure we don't make the same mistakes.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, we're thinking about an ecosystem of tools. And one of the things that comes up in the tools that we currently have that were built independently is that, you know, we're all very, very busy. And they're asking us for the same information over and over and over again. And I just don't, I can't handle that, okay? So I want to be able to put my information in a place, and then I want the tools to be able to use it. And so we're talking to Community of Science and the NIH and the NSF and all of the folks that make tools so that we'll be able to reuse the information that we're providing about ourselves. So that really all you should have to provide is your address. And if you provide your address, then we can go to work. And so that's sort of our vision for the future of this thing. Is to really cut down the amount of rework that are involved in things like participating in all of these different activities.
And what I was going to suggest about our online modules is that I think that they work best as an introduction to the whole phenomenon of team science. And I think something we've learned is if courses or if institutions are going to start to offer courses in team science, These make very useful homework assignments. They make good in-class discussion. So this is how some of our evidence-based practice tools are used. Someone will assign them for a week's reading, and then they'll talk about them in class. I think we will probably want to think about linking our sites together so people who are looking for expertise in the area can find it, can be directed to where these things are.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And I think each of us should probably try to be articulate about where we think our tools would best serve their purpose. I think, for example, the wizard works best when you're fairly far along in at least defining a collaboration and just want to get a check on whether it's sort of heading in the right direction. I think it would not be a very good tool to get started with. I think it really assumes that you sort of identify the participants, you've identified the problem area, you have some preliminary ideas about what you're going to do and so on, and then you can answer the questions. Otherwise, I think you'd be clueless as to how to answer the questions.
So one of the things that we're hoping with the toolkit, and so I think many of the examples that we had, so for instance, Bonnie's and Gary's, I think are things that are relevant for going into our toolkit to sort of point people back. As was mentioned, I think there are different contexts in which these different tools can be used, different stages of the collaborative process, different stages of a researcher's career trajectory, and when some of these would be more or less relevant. And so I think having the capacity for the toolkit to be able to point people to, okay, this is a toolkit, this is a tool that could be used at this stage as recommended by the developers, and in this type of context. And I think that also I'd be interested in people's thoughts on whether some kind of rating or common options for these tools. So in other words, someone could go in and say, well, you know, I had an opportunity to use this with my undergraduates, and they didn't seem quite ready, but when I used it with my postdocs, they thought this was, you know, a fantastic thing. So, you know, that kind of ways, which would provide guidance to help streamline people's choices.
One other constituency that I think is going to be really important here is the research development officers, because I think that a lot of what is inherent in the science of team science is people don't know it exists, and they don't know that there is something they don't know. And it's the position of the research development officer to say, oh, this is something that I think would help you. So I think the group that you're leading, Holly, is going to be really, really dynamic and influential.
Well, I think another audience for some of these tools is program managers at funding agencies.
Hi. I actually have two questions and one request. Tina Cheatwood from George Washington University. My first question is related to this as well, is looking at the science of team science training for faculty. I think the first person that asked the question was looking for students. And I'm curious as to whether other institutions have formal training programs for faculty to do this, or if it's been more of an organic process. I personally have kind of one foot as an investigator, as a researcher in one door, and then another foot as a research developer, so I kind of wear two hats. And so I'm really interested in my faculty and how we can help them develop these skills purposefully and not by accident. Any advice?
I think I'm going to ask Holly to address this, because I'm unaware of anything except one offering that I think didn't go particularly well. It wasn't at Northwestern.
The organization that will remain nameless did attempt to do this the first time, and it didn't go wildly well. So they're working on it to redo. There are actually institutions who offer up programs, not a team science training program per se, but about team science and leadership training. And so if you come back next year, Brian Utsi will actually be offering up a full-day workshop on team science and leadership. Now, you probably don't want to have to wait 12 full months. So there are other institutions that are starting to incorporate this into their faculty development programs. Our graduate-level course actually started as an idea because I gave a short workshop to early career faculty on team science training and that went pretty well. So I have a short set of slides as a place to start, but we can work on trying to connect folks. And if any of your institutions have, as part of your faculty development programs, anything related to team science and leadership for teams, you know, let us know and we'll look to disseminate that information.
So at NIH, we've had the opportunity to include, as part of panels and symposiums, or part of workshops, some training around this. So it's kind of happening in little fits and starts, but nothing too formal.
It's good to know, because I think you're right up the street from us.
If I can just, what we found is that when we've administered the wizard to colleagues initially at UCI, just the questions themselves are educational. It sort of highlights, you know, areas that need to think about. And so that has turned out to be kind of a nice side benefit.
And my second question, Gary, is actually for you. I was really interested in looking at your factors for successful collaboration. And given some prevalent attitudes, both from investigators and from leadership, about get the grant first, worry about it later, how do you mitigate that reality?
Probably by education. And it is the case that at least I'm most familiar with the National Science Foundation, where most of our funding has come from, that in the last few years, their requirements and their applications have changed a little bit. They've asked more explicit questions about project management and so on. And so I think sort of programs, and maybe it's true at NIH as well, I don't know, there's sort of increased sensitivity at some of the funding agencies about what some of the relevant factors need to be. And so I think that's one promising direction.
Great. And one really short request, and I promise I'm done. But Bonnie, I loved what you presented. Talk about giddy. I'm ready to jump up and down. And my only request is that are you considering having a CBPR wing, a community-based participatory research wing, or is that falling under behavioral?
It's a wonderful question, and in fact, our community engaged research center was so upset that we didn't we didn't do that one. As you can see from the 2-year timeline, this is funded by ARRA funding.
Right.
And so what ARRA from the CTSA supplement gave us enough to do was the science of team science, the didactic module, the basic biomedical science module, and the clinical medical science module. I scrambled and got the additional money from OBSSR to do the behavioral science one. There simply wasn't enough money to do the CBPR one, but I think it is really exactly where we need to go. I think it's the least developed how we should do that. It's probably the most pragmatically public health-wise important. So I think probably it's the kind of thing we should put in a supplemental request to do yet another one.
I think so, but I'm a little biased. Thanks. Thank
you. Jack Schultz from Missouri. Both trying to describe or construct networks and identify human resources requires acquiring data about the people involved, like the first project we heard about. Two approaches to that are asking people to provide those data, but that's a self-selecting process. Only people who are interested will do that, and we've already heard several of us say we don't want to do that more than once. What we'd all like, of course, is a more automated data mining approach to that. My limited experience in this area suggests that not only do no two universities record the same data, if they record the data at all, but even within the university, the data are frequently incomplete, incompatible. Even the software systems don't talk to each other. Is there hope for a solution to this problem?
So the first answer is yes, that they are incompatible, and yes, there is hope. So we have 7 schools implementing, and the 7 stories are fabulously and wonderfully diverse and different. Okay, so as I mentioned, we have a meeting place, an ontology that describes how the data should be presented and what we're looking for.
And faculty have publications, so that's a meeting place. Where do those publications come from? We're working with publishers to be able to automate processes by which the publishers have already aggregated the data, and that data could become available. And so we're in the business of buying down the cost of automating those processes for the production of profiles that are reasonably complete. And we understand that there are gaps, there are things that the faculty member would want to have on their profile that we were unable to automate for them. In the end, the faculty member controls the profile. So if they want to add information that couldn't come from the automation processes, that's fine. If they want to remove things that were provided by the automation processes, that's fine. But yes, there is tremendous diversity. There is a technical activity involved in mapping the data that the institution has to the formats that are required for some kind of semantic interchange. And so building an expertise around that is part of the work that we're doing, and providing guidance about that to other institutions is also part of the work that we're doing.
Maybe funding agencies can help make the database uniform by requiring grant applications to include a certain body of information, which then is publicly accessible because the taxpayers paid for it and you can use it.
Yeah, I'm wondering, is Julia Lane here?
No, Julia isn't here. I'll be making her presentation on SISIP, but we can get where
she's thinking about it.
She sure couldn't, unlike Bill, manage to get somebody to give her a plane to get here.
Right, so she's a fabulous proponent of trying to get the kind of data that you're talking about in action, even at a larger scale than just NSF. From the government perspective, there's always this strange tension between releasing information that we collect versus the fact that it is public dollars that are, and so that's been a really difficult barrier for us to overcome, because clearly all of the researchers who are applying, especially now that things are electronic, we're collecting a lot of the data that's probably needed. And so I think a lot of it's really will be helped by the community of scientists who are giving the data expressing their desire to have that data used, because I think right now there's this feeling that they don't want it. And so us mandating that, people are concerned about privacy issues. So I think a richer dialogue is needed to help that understanding be clearer.
Dave Stone, Northern Illinois University. Just two quick things, because I know I'm standing between all of us and lunch. One is that, and I don't want to overstate this at all, but just from what was presented so far for each of your sort of publicly available systems, there is a subtle presumption that the key users for this are potential leaders of teams. And I don't want us to forget that very often teams get formed because other people who are secondary players or facilitators are the ones who end up yoking together people at better resource universities or with better pedigrees or longer lists of grants to get that team going. And so I think in each of these cases, it will be very valuable if there are places where those people can recognize themselves in what they're using and reading here, so that they can say, oh, if I'm me in this situation, how do I link to that guy, and how do I connect these, and then get out of the way and let the team form in the rest of the ways that it will. But for that facilitating moment for the people from smaller schools or postdocs or young faculty, new investigators, they do play a role, because we've all seen it, in teams coalescing. So that was one point, if you wanted to speak to that first.
Well, I just want to say that when we gave the wizard to the 40-some people associated with the CTSA proposal at Irvine, that was a very revealing part of it, because, you know, only one of those people was the leader. The other 39 were the people who were going to be doing a lot of the work. And it was very, very useful to get that wide range of information.
Two things. One, in the case-based scenarios we'll be creating, we hope to be able to offer our perspective on some of those issues. The other thing that has come through very clearly and been quite interesting to me is, as we've interviewed people about the nature of leadership and who's the leader, We hear about a literature that says, well, it's the charismatic visionary, the person who pulls the team together. But we hear that in about half of the cases, it's the facilitator. It's the person who empowers other people to step forward and brings out the best in them. So I think that message is something we'll be pressing. And I think actually this whole concept, I missed yesterday's meeting, the first day of the meeting, because I was giving a presentation to HRSA in D.C. about interprofessional teams. And what strikes me is the degree of crossover between the scientific research community and the practice-based research community, where this notion of team-based competencies and the ability to distribute leadership and to function like a team where people are watching your back, they're able to pick up the ball if somebody's dropping it. I think our notion of leadership is becoming more distributed.
My second thought was, a reminder that the S in STEM is science, and part of the unheard part of that S is often the organization of science. And one of the things we do a fairly lousy job of in high school and K-12 is explaining how science is organized. And this being a new dimension of the way science is organized and run, I think in each case, again, you all have the potential to include in your publicly available stuff information for high school teachers and even middle school teachers so that students at a younger age can get used to the notion that the way you're going to do this if you want to become a scientist is to work in teams and work collaboratively and in those ways. So bring this back to the whole STEM community, too. It might also open up some funding possibilities for exploring science of team science through STEM funding. So that's my